Well, we're on number 20. I guess that's somewhere.
Right?
For 400
I know.
Deals.
Well, I told them yesterday. I was like,
good afternoon, everyone. We have achieved critical mass, which is to say that we do have a quorum present. So I will call to order this meeting of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is the 30th of March. We are going to be considering a public hearing on House Bill 5019. So I'll go ahead and open that public hearing in review of the budget for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Ms. Dyster, where are we at?
We are on slide 20, and they were just about to launch into the public safety and licensing program.
Well, it sounds exciting. Why don't we bring Mr. Marks and his team up, and we can wade right in.
I'm excited.
Marks.
Thank you. Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC, with me again is Bill Schutte, our economist, and Dustin here from DAS. Public safety licensing program. So we're going to go through, finish up on public safety and its licensing part, some of the interesting aspects of marijuana enforcement, go into our integrated administration and support structure, talk a little bit more specifically about the marijuana program as the program, and then look at the some of the financials and distribution for the agency. So with that, following up, and this sort of relates to, we ended on the KPMs yesterday that we're going to prioritize enforcement for both alcohol and marijuana programs. I've currently directed that we move our staff that have been working on licensing to enforcement where they belong full-time, and we need to get back to get some of those dipping KPMs on alcohol back up to where they need to be. It was the right thing to do to utilize them, I believe, and we didn't suffer too many adverse consequences. We saw slight reductions in some of our output, but we got to get them back doing their job there. And in marijuana, the enforcement issues are now in front of us, and we need to get out and enforce to make sure that this new system is compliant and that our licensees understand our diligence on enforcement. We want to increase our decoy activity. That includes both on the alcohol side to get that back up, and then initiate them really on the marijuana side where we haven't had the opportunity yet to get on decoy programs. And there the looks are not just for sales to minors age 21 and or below age 21, but also to ensure that sales to medical card holders are done properly, because if you could have improper tax avoidance if otherwise there, because the medical product is not taxed at retail.
Mr. Chair.
Please, Co-Chair.
Are you tracking at all, or is this an OHA problem? Are you tracking the proliferation of doctors that were, you know, 5 minute fog a mirror and you get a medical marijuana card? Are you guys tracking that, given the tax avoidance possibilities?
Co-Chair Johnson, no, we're not tracking that. You know, we have.
Should OHA do it? Should somebody pay attention?
Yes, and OHA does pay attention to that. The legislation that is currently being considered creates a, I'm going to mess up its proper name, but a medical cannabis board that's looking at refining the oversight issues, both in, I think, in terms of patients and what kind of access they have, and also around the, I don't know how deep, the legislation's not perfected, so I don't know how exact its focus is going to be on the issue you raise.
Assuming some, follow up, Mr. Chair, assuming somebody out there in agency land is listening, having a board with some balance would be wonderful. I don't know who the appointing authority is, but to have a whole board full of medical marijuana card holders and a few of them docs would not be my idea of adequate input on this important issue.
The just so you know, and this is the initial structure, and obviously it's not done. I think it had roughly three medical cannabis users are 3 from the cannabis industry, 3 public health and physicians, and 3 public, I believe. So that's the initial unrefined composition that it was first proposed with.
It'd be lovely if law enforcement had a spot, but you don't have to respond.
But I'm going to follow up, Mr. Marks, on the co-chair's oblique reference to tax avoidance. Certainly the medical marijuana program is important for those who rely on that opportunity, if I could call it that. And there may be some people that that might be marginally involved, and that's not my call to make. But are there any estimates of people that are truly relying on the medical program for tax avoidance and that don't properly belong there?
Bill, if you recall seeing any real estimates of that along the way, there's been a lot of that discussion in reference to medical card holders and maybe the undeserving.
I'm going to rephrase my question as a starting point for this. Do you think this is a real or a perceived problem?
I definitely perceived that it was a real issue. You know, I think our program that was created under OMMP was created for a variety of purposes initially, and I think people used it to gain access to marijuana so that they would not run into trouble with law enforcement and their use of marijuana. And, you know, the world's changing. We now have recreational marijuana that's legal. There is a cost to getting a card, you know, so there's a nexus there about, you know, does it really make sense anymore for a lot of those folks that maybe were on the more recreational side of the use that they may not pursue their cards in the future. But, yes, it is an issue, and I think that's one of the things that as we look at regulating the medical system, we're talking about how much free product you could share out of our system. We will be tracking free sharing in our system, but it became an issue. We didn't want to set the bar for that sharing for some of the most legitimate ailments, cancer, seizures, all that, which may need pounds, 40 pounds, you know, put into oils. Well, you didn't want to set the bar for sharing with those high cases. We wanted to set the bar lower and generally. So one of the things that this medical cannabis board could help us do is determine the easy and penetrable way to share up. And so that begins to get towards some of the issues that Senator Johnson was raising, but it's not spot on. It's a step in a direction of more refinement of allocations of shared medical marijuana to patients.
So I asked whether the problem was real or perceived. You said you perceive that it's real. Thank you. And I'll just ask that if you do come across any information that details the extent of this this problem, you share it with our professional staff, and we'll get it out to the other committee members. But let's go ahead and continue with the presentation. Thank you.
Absolutely. So we want to increase licensee visits. We do believe education's enforcement. You heard us emphasize that yesterday. Getting to the second, visits after a violation, important. First visits are important. Education is the best way for us to get compliance. We're continuing to integrate the marijuana and public safety programs together. That's been at least from the financial side, really tricky. And we do have an allocation formula between the budgets that help us do that. We're coordinating our field office activities and compliance outcomes to get more statewide consistency. Very important to us. You know, we saw our regional offices, our satellite offices. We want consistent enforcement. And then we want increased accountability in our own records. Our records and retrieval are not good. This is part of that IT planning that we need to put together, but it's important in public safety because it's some of the basis on which we pursue violations, you know, that the police reports get automated, that they get in, that they're retrievable for use when our folks are meeting with the judges, the ALJs, and pursuing the cases. So with that,
for for the record again, Bill Schutte, economist with the Liquor Control Commission. Just go through some of the numbers, the universe of entities we regulate. Right now, there's approximately over 15,000 annual licenses in the liquor sector. The majority of those are restaurants, bars, grocery store, convenience stores, but a fair amount of wineries, breweries, brew pubs, distilleries. And in addition, we do issue what they call special event licenses for concerts and food fairs and one-time things. By the day, we issued almost 9,000 of those last year. And then out-of-state certificates, those manufacturers that ship beer and wine into the state, we have to track those as well. And then, of course, the alcohol service permits, those restaurants, or people that work in restaurants and serve alcohol. Over the last 10 years, this has been growing at about an average rate. The total licenses of about 2.5% per year, but of course, there are some sectors such as wineries, brew pubs, and especially distilleries that have grown, some of them in excess of 25% per year. As we move to the marijuana side, the universe of entities we regulate, the first column is the current number of active and approved licenses. Some of you may not be familiar with the different license types. So the laboratories are the licenses that test the product before it goes in or test the harvest as it comes out. Processors are those entities that move raw product, cannabis, into products such as vape, hash oil, edibles, that sort of thing. Producers are the actual growers. As you can see, that's almost half the licensees we have in the state so far are producers. The retailers, of course, the 398 retailers is a comparable number to the number of the dispensaries that were in practice before the initiation of our system. A few wholesalers are the ones that move, transport, and sometimes store marijuana. And as of yet, we have to have not issued any research certificates. There was a accommodation in the legislation that would allow some research entities to be able to test stuff if they applied for it and met specific conditions, including tracking in the cannabis tracking system. And then moving through our gap, we'll talk about is application for licenses in the second column yet to be processed. We've processed over 1,000 so far, but we have over 1,200 that are still have yet to be processed. This has been just a little disconcerting to us that we were only expecting 1,000 license applications to begin with, and now here we are in this part of the year and thinking we'd be almost done and on a kind of a glide path now, but we're in the process of having to deal with another 1,200 applications.
Senator Johnson.
What happens if you are not resourced to the degree that you're asking? What's the delay factor? What happens? What's plan B?
Senator Johnson, Co-Chair Johnson, plan B would be we would continue with our existing licensing staff to put out marijuana licenses at a slower rate. The system would gain less revenue. We would not be able to hire additional enforcement because we're self-financed by the fees off these, so we would be in a current services budget level and producing them with now three staff because we do have enforcement issues in marijuana. We will keep the enforcement personnel working on enforcement.
Follow-up?
My reason for asking is I've just come from a meeting over the noon hour talking about just how serious our budget situation is. And I'm coming to the realization much more dramatically than even when we walked in the building that there are going to be a lot of cuts in budgets. And I'm certainly not suggesting that, you know, they're going to cut your program, but enhancements are going to be hard to come by. And I'm just trying to figure out if I were applying for a card or a renewal, how long is my expected wait? Can you take people off the liquor side? Are you able to quantify the loss of revenue so that it makes it more obvious to Ways and Means about what's being left on the table absent additional bodies to help you do what you need to do?
I'll let Bill answer the quantification issue. I think we can do that somewhat, but not very precisely at this point. But, you know, it does have a relationship. The more licenses we put out, The more system we build internally, the more enforcement we're going to be able to put out to oversee licensees as well. You know, you roughly have a doubling here. You roughly have a doubling of program with the self-contained, self-financed growth. Part of that growth is that it's all carried on the fees that go on to marijuana licensees. They're the payers of this program. We are not funded by any of the distributions or tax revenues. The marijuana licensees finance this program. But it would, so it's self-contained, and there would be some loss of revenue generated, but, you know, how do you say how much the sales fall off from a retailer that's selling a lot right now? And if you add how much is that as the market is being diluted by the new entries, and how much is that as actual market gain?
Well, that's my other question, is if you just spread a finite number of customers over more stores, or whether you're starting from the assumption that more stores equal more customers, if you judge by State Street, you're going to run out of smokers before you run out of stores. And I'm just trying to figure out what gets left on the table if you don't get these additional bodies.
Co-Chair Johnson, I will go through a revised forecast based on these additional licensees. Again, this is a fee-funded program. We have the ability to change those fees and rule, so there is ability to match the fees to the resource needs.
Follow up one more time?
You bet.
Up to a point, the fees get too high, and why would anybody want to participate in the legal system when they can just head down to the southwest or the southeastern part of the state and take care of business by themselves?
Senator Johnson, yes, you have a point there. And that's why all the fees done for the rulemaking require a Rules Advisory Committee, so we will have industry involvement, stakeholder involvement with this process.
Good balanced Rules Advisory Committees, right?
Yes, Sam.
Just to finish up the FAR column, right now, this has been a forecast in flux. Back when the GRB was prepared, we had initially projected about 1,100 licensees in the system. Now, with the current deluge of applications, we have a new forecast of close to 1,700 licensees that could eventually be coming into the system. And then on top of that, workers' permits. In addition, no matter what happens with the medical system, we are seeing more medical growers coming in, or believe are medical growers, because they are not having a place to move their product to. So that is another pressure being put on as well. And then getting to the gap issue. So everything through February, here is a graph of the cumulative licenses we've issued since the beginning of the program through February. Those are the green bars. The red bar is our original forecast of licenses, applications we thought we were going to receive. The bars after February are the number of licenses we could process with the three FTE that Mr. Marks mentioned. The top blue line is the actual number of applications we received. And then the dotted orange line after February is our most best guess now as to how many applications we would expect to receive going forward into the biennium. And again, there is a growing gap there that we would have to be, that has to be addressed if we intend to process the licenses. In addition to the gap, this is the same chart, a little different colors, but in addition to that, we were going to have renewals coming on, so the gap even gets bigger with the 3FTE. Again, it's just something that these renewals are more complex than alcohol. We expect to have to do a little more on-site inspections than alcohol as business practices change, business entities change, businesses reorganize. And again, this is, you know, a gap that would have to be met with additional resources. For the marijuana permit applications, there is a less of a gap. We seem to be, for the most part, keeping up with those, but this is, again, just shows the great potential for growth. Right now, we have almost 15,000 applications for marijuana worker permits, those people that work in the industry. As far as the trend is, we continue to see that grow, maybe reaching as high as 30,000 by the end of the biennium. This is on a comparable side, comparable to the alcohol server permits that serve in bars and restaurants.
Mr. Chair.
Senator?
I think you just answered my question, but I'm not sure. These are all in-store. These aren't field personnel. This is just...
No, Co-Chair Johnson, these are all the workers in the industry. The initial bill, House Bill 3400, was just going to have worker permits required for people working in the stores. 2016, they changed the requirement to have all workers in the industry. So it includes stores, people working in labs, people working in processors, people working in the field.
And just to note, we do criminal background checks on those folks.
So any worker in the industry, does that include workers that have no contact at all with the product?
Does not include workers that have no contact with the product, Rep. Gomberg. So you could be a consultant with no contact with the product, not be an employee.
I could be the company CPA. Okay.
And just a side note, these workers also have to be registered to be able to enter information into the cannabis tracking system. So that's another link to the compliance.
Senator, you look like you've got a question.
Thank you. Thank you, though.
Please continue.
To me, marijuana compliance concerns. So, you know, this demand's created significant concerns about enforcement in marijuana and compliance with the more than 1,200 applications and growing daily in the backlog and 1,000 out there. Grower licenses, as I think I noted earlier yesterday, are complicated. Their operations change. We do field visits. They have, you know, buildings for dryings that we have approvals on. They have certain security requirements that we have to see and make sure work in the field. And grow operations are, of course, the biggest risk of diversion from our system.
I do have a question.
Please.
If you get a situation where somebody is growing and they're in violation of county land use, would that be an automatic revocation by you guys? Let's just say, hypothetically, somebody just builds a 5,000-square-foot building next to their house in a quasi-residential zone, and they start cranking out dope. That's clearly in violation of local zoning. Can you revoke them at that point?
We can. What we've built into our Co-Chair Johnson, what we've built into our licensing system, we don't proceed until we have a land use compatibility statement from the county. But, you know, if someone subsequently built an illegal building, yes, we could.
Let's just say mine's not a hypothetical interest. We've got issues. And I'm just trying to figure out who's the court of last resort, because the county is not terribly enthusiastic about shutting this down, but you could choke off the license for failure to meet land use compatibility?
Yes, we could.
Thank you.
Yeah, they'd have to be our licensee.
Okay, and if they are not your licensee, but there is product in the building?
I think I've dealt with this one. It is a law enforcement matter, it is a county matter, and it is dependent and somewhat a bit on whether they're a OHA grower or not, but generally county or criminal.
What I'm trying to figure out, colleagues, is this issue of everybody like this. Figuring out community compatibility with the grow right over the fence, and there is no responsible party. And we end up with constituents who are sent from agency to law enforcement to someplace else, and they just don't seem to have a place where there is suitable redress for some of the incompatible issues that are created by now the proliferation of particularly grow.
Co-Chair Johnson, huge problem in every county, every city, and we get those inquiries about whose grow is it every day. And there is great confusion, and we can tell them whether it's our grow or not, but it's harder to tell them whether it's an OHA grow, an illegal grow, a hemp grow, which are being confused for marijuana grows. And it is creating a lot of consternation both amongst law enforcement, local government, and the general public. And you don't see the setbacks or controls that we have because we get land use compatibility statements before we move forward.
Mr. Chair, I haven't quite beaten this to death, so give me one more shot at it.
Yes, ma'am.
One of the things that is a source of constant frustration to me is the paucity of guidance that the agencies give the legislature. And you and I have talked about this before. You all are the experts on the front lines of doing this. And I don't know whether or not you are in a position to come forward with a suite of recommendations, like no wrong door, that somehow you have an ombudsman person who sends a call off to someplace else, not just, hello, you're not our problem, click. Once upon a time, DHS tried that with the notion of no wrong door, that if there was a call, somebody handled it to a point that it could be dealt with. And I don't know, between OHA, you guys, law enforcement, where do the poor old citizens end up? And can you have some kind of a forum where you all get to that point where there is a referral so that somebody follows this stuff through to a logical conclusion?
Co-Chair Johnson, yes, and we have plans to do that. We have do a lot of it today, but, you know, the door might be a door from us to another agency that might not be able to give you information based on the statutes. You know, medical, they don't give out information on the medical grows specifically on sites. That makes it hard to know. State police, though, or local follow-ups, we have referred issues that have come to us to the appropriate holders, I think, of the enforcement authority, but that doesn't mean that the door has a result right now. One of the things that would help is the idea that bringing all of the grows into a singular system that is tracked, that is identified grows, that such as we were running with Metric. As you know, the politics, quite frankly, of getting to that are heavily embedded. We are making progress, I think, and getting more identification and work and more people across the fence to a track system, but it's not something we have a mandate to do yet.
Sure. Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Kind of a follow-up, if you had that, would you be able to treat marijuana like you do alcohol? From
Rev.
A
Noble,
to Z.
Co-chairs, Rev. Noble.
I'm talking specifically about investigations, because if I start a homebrew and end up selling it, you're going to come knock at my door. It's not going to be the county sheriff.
Yeah. Yes. We would then be looking at them. They'd be under administrative violations under our system, right? We look to do that first, unless there's real criminal activity, and then we'll bring in law enforcement to pursue the criminal activity. But, yes, that would make for more uniform enforcement similar to alcohol.
Thank you.
Continuing. Market incentives, you know, there's a lot of incentives, of course, to invert and divert, and with the growth of our system, that is an issue with us. We talked a little bit about, you know, the sheer numbers coming in and that creating market pressures in our system, whether they can make enough sales, so that's going to put pressure on our enforcement side. We have packaging and labeling oversight and pre-approvals. We're up to snuff on that. We've done 1,500 combined, I think, approvals of packages and the labeling that go onto the packages of marijuana with all the warnings. We run into and have run into some of our larger compliance issues where we have large quantities of product and really licensees that have fully failed to thrive in our system that we're in the business of taking out of our system, but figuring out how to deal with 1,600 pounds of marijuana on site and hold it securely, get it through the administrative process is an issue that we're confronting. State police is a nice evidence storage facility. Really requires the product to be quite dry and in paper bags, so we couldn't utilize that fully in this case. Some of the legislation that will pass will be of aid to us because we might be able to use our licensees as contractors to hold the product. We do have warehouse licenses and others, but it's a substantial time sink and staff investment when we have these kind of failures. And, you know, hopefully it's going to be less than 10% of our licensee system, hopefully well less than 10% that's in us. But right now we've had a couple significant events like this, and, you know, I can see us marching through numbers where we're sending out, you know, four people on weekends to actually secure the product. We also have product that fails pesticide tests that's held on site that needs to be destroyed, and we need evidence of its destruction. To date, we haven't initiated any destructs. It's all on hold at the facilities, wherever it is. It's in packages, quantified weight. If it's not there, our licensees are in violation. We will follow up with sanctions. But we are putting in place and figuring out how we do this verifiable statewide destroy of materials that have failed to pass tests and do not move into the market. So we still need to figure out how to do that efficiently. And then our tracking system has allowed us to, and we've initiated one, allows us to track back product. We've done one product recall to date. It was a pesticide analyte. It was slightly over the limits, and we have detection limits. They're not really health safety limits in what we look for and what's looked for in the testing standards. And we had a licensee that made 31 sales of about 83 grams of product that had failed the pesticide test. The failure in the system came out of a lab that had reported the water tests and the potency tests forward, and that went to the product did go to the retailer based on its passage of those. The retailer believed it had passed tests and made the sales. They subsequently got from the lab the report on the failed pesticide test. It was the retailer that saw it, called us, noticed it, initiated, worked with us to initiate the recall. So that part of the system worked really well. Our licensee was extremely responsible. And we did have a bit of a failure or a problem that we hadn't confronted here about lab reports coming up all at the same time. There's an issue we're going to look at in our cannabis tracking system to see if we can lock that down so that no lab reports can go forward until all lab reports are completed. Right now it doesn't provide for that, but the lab ultimately had the responsibility for making sure the tests all got forwarded. The retailers in our system ultimately have the responsibility to make sure all of the accurate information is on the product when it comes into their shop.
Senator.
You used the word responsibility. I'm going to ask you to respond to the word liability. What happens if a load of marijuana ends up in a retail setting and someone is damaged as a result of smoking pesticide-laden marijuana? What risk is the state?
Co-Chair Johnson. I don't believe the state's at much liability. I do think the licensees, you know, this is an unknown area. There hasn't been a ton of litigation about it yet, but you can expect it, and it's coming. You probably have more of awareness and expertise in this committee to project what that would look like.
Do you require of your licensees that they carry a minimum amount of consumer liability insurance?
We would have required that they do so if it was available on the market. It was a difficulty
point
for them to get liability insurance. We wanted to make it a requirement. And Jesse, correct me if I'm wrong, wherever you are. Is it a requirement now or not? It's not now. So we currently do not have it as a requirement. There are some, we've worked with DCBS. There are some parties that are writing liability insurance. Some of those policies really weren't to great effect with specifically covering them on the marijuana portion of their operations. DCBS has written some notices to look at more comprehensive policies for these licensees.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I'm going to ask this question to our real estate professional. I would assume that for people to lease buildings for commercial activities, that there might be a requirement for a commercial policy. And I'm just curious if there isn't policy availability in the marketplace, how are those landlords protected from somebody, you know, cooking hash oil with butane, just let's say hypothetically?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, co-chair and co-chairs. What you're going to find right now, a lot of these operations are working and operating out of their owned properties, and they're using private funds to buy those properties. Right now, if a property owner, commercial building owner, leases to somebody and the federal government comes in and seizes everything, that property owner can actually lose their property, too.
Given the differential in the federal response to marijuana as far as its schedule.
And yes, co-chair. And also, their mortgage company, if they have any financing, will not allow that also. So it's a lot of the operations out there are being self-funded and or kind of combined fundings from different partners, and it's very difficult to find any financing that's through the normal means. But I do have a question, co-chair. Do we have any feedback or background to what the states of Washington or Colorado are doing for any type of liability, or do they have any types of programs that they're currently using?
Co-chairs and Representative Meek, you know, I don't know on liability. I've talked with them about banking and their access to banking, and I just don't. I'll be meeting with them next week. I'll get back to you on that.
But, Thank you, Director. Mike.
Question?
Please, Senator.
I'm just curious, how many... the size scope difference of, excuse me, when a batch or a load or whatever quantified unit comes in, how many tests and what kind of tests does each load get subjected to? What are we looking for? You said herbicides, but what else?
This co-chairs, Senator Hansel, this could take a long time if I could do it accurately all the way through. We do a lot of testing. It is one of the, I think, most comprehensive testing batteries next to prescription drugs right now that we provide. It is certainly not random. It's not like any other agricultural crop, and it is extensive. We use detection levels for pesticides, and they cover a number of pesticide analytes that were identified by the scientific committee. They look for water activity. They look for THC potency. It is an extensive battery of tests. It's also, the industry, as I said, very expensive for them, right? This is a product that has been commonly used before, and there is the differences here about what is a safe level and how should it be regulated and why or why not should it be regulated differently with respect to pesticides. The industry is maintaining that they'd like to go to more agricultural-based standards. We test not only in our system, the batch size that is generally tested in flour is 10 pounds. And OHA is testing every 10-pound batch size. So that covers every field. We currently, on our side, had some dispensation early on when there were volume problems in labs, and we are doing 33% of that. So our batch size is essentially is 30 pounds right now in the recreational system, and that's what they use to draw the tests and samples from. They test the extracts and the concentrates, and concentrates actually concentrate pesticides. So that's an important test. So the system is designed to test all finished product heading to market.
Okay. Thank you.
Follow up, Senator?
Does your testing put a value on the product then? If you are testing the potency of it, I know in the alcohol beverages there are levels of alcohol which I think add or not to the cost of the final product?
Co-chairs, we don't do that, but I do think the marketplace does that, and generally, you know, higher THC potency is a more valuable product in the flower.
Any other questions? Mr. Marks, while we're talking about compliance, and I'm going to ask a question that takes us off in a slightly different direction, because you're talking about compliance issues. We just finished talking about an unexpectedly high number of license applications. We certainly know that not all of those applications are successful. That is, that we see a lot of businesses that start, a lot of businesses that are failing. Usually that's a recipe for people that aren't paying their bills. And I've been looking at a variety of different agencies. You seem to have a lot of money coming through yours, and I go to an agency like the Board of Mortuary and Cemeteries that has delinquent debt of over $100,000. The delinquent debt in your agency is about $1,000. What's your secret?
Co-Chair Gomberg, I appreciate you reviewing that with me when I came to your office. You know, this is a business. OLCC runs a business enterprise. You know, I get a profits and loss monthly report. We pay attention to our widgets to the detail. I just got to share this with you. It's on my iPhone. I got some statistics from my trusty Merle Lindsay in Portland there.
And I did ask you about this when you came to my office, but I didn't tell you I was going to ask you again. Yeah. So.
Well, I was going to cover this in the financial report in our support services, but I had him share with me our 2016 annual warehouse audit results. We shipped 3.1 million of cases of liquor. We were in our inventory count at the end of the year over 380 bottles. We had an overcount of 380 bottles. The value of that was $16,650. So our rate of being off is 0.00149%. Tremendous. We are, and I think that's one of the differences. And I didn't understand that so much when I was a policy advisor around other parts of here, but we spend the money. This is really a business enterprise that we operate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of things you see with our financials, we're looking at costs constantly and looking at error rates and shipment. And it's impressive what they've done. I can't say I've only been there 3.5 years. So we're 22 years Gold Star accounting in the agency now, and it continues today. We have a Secretary of State's audit come in, and I welcome it. I think, you know, we have a great system, and the only thing that it can do is help us find a few improvements.
Well, I've just got to say, Mr. Marks, I run a business, too, and I have accounts, and I got to tell you that not all my accounts have paid me. If I could go one step further, I would say that that my small company is owed more money than your agency is owed. And what I'm hearing from you is that your delinquent debt, your receivables are down because you pay attention to that detail.
Well, let me there is one secret here I think that makes it easier to collect, Chair Gomberg, and that is we don't have to issue them a renewal on their license unless they're current, or a contract if they're an agent store. So they do have an incentive to keep current with us. We also do, you know, the system I described with our contract agents. They pay us the full cost of the bottle, and we remit their compensation to them. So if there's problems, we deduct it from compensation.
All right. Thank you.
That's
nice business model.
Yeah. If you can get it, take it.
I don't want to underemphasize the fact that we've got businesses that are discontinuing, and they don't have that incentive to make sure that they're keeping their accounts current. So something is going on in this agency that I don't see going on in some others. So let's please continue.
Let me just wrap up on with the point on the one slide that, you know, we don't have protocols for a lot of the law enforcement questions that we're handling. They just aren't out there. So every kind of issue that we face is, there are a lot of unique ones. It's conflict between state and federal law. It's conflict between state and state law. We have issues with jurisdiction, and it's across you know, natural resource issues. It's across law enforcement. It's across employment issues. So it's just a lot of time. But in enforcement, it is present and has created some gaps for us to figure out how we deal with product. If law enforcement is not going to criminally prosecute something and we have an issue, we have defaulted to bring product into our system so it is not diverted into illegal markets. And that's been our operational imprimatur, or we would destroy it but not allow it to get to the legal market if we have clear authorities over it. We don't have authorities over, say, marijuana that's been produced at our site is resting at another site, and DAs are not prosecuting, and there's no criminal penalty that's going to be associated with that. So how do we get it back into our system? How do we make sure that we can take control and custody of that and make sure that it's handled properly instead of simply being diverted to the black market? It's a significant question. We hope to get some additional protections and statutes for us to be able to confidently make decisions like that. Prevention compliance approach. There's three big parts to this. Really, it's our rules and the security requirements in our rules, cameras, backup cameras, alarms, locking storage on site, the transportation manifests that protect both the licensee and allow law enforcement to know that they're carrying recreational materials. The cannabis tracking system, it's the heart of our accountability or system that allows us to flag issues and see issues. It generally doesn't prescribe. You know, you can't look at the data and say, oh, there is a violation. There are a few of those in the system, and it might be helpful if we can be smart enough to figure a few of the, more of them out. But, for instance, we identified through the cannabis tracking system 140 approximately instances where they hadn't repackaged product that was harvested after our requirement of repackaging it within 45 days. And package is an amorphous item in our system. It can be a physical package. It could be just weighed again in bulk on the other side. But we know it's there. We know it's in a new state. We get a new measurement. Through calling these folks and through bulletins and warnings, we give them a month to get their data right in our metric system. We are still investigating about 39 of those remaining. So those are the kinds of issues and the kinds of follow-up. And you see here on the chart sort of the numbers of some of those metric issues. Some of those are outright. A lot of those are just mistakes. We're finding that a lot of them are that we have to get rectified in the system, but you know, some of those are real violations and some people are trying to get around the system. That's why we need field enforcement. You can't run and operate the system with accountability without sending someone out and finding out. Not in all these instances, but we're setting up our protocols for prioritizing the way and the systems that we use to use the tracking system to flag those kind of things that come to our attention to make sure that we're diligent in getting field enforcement in place with it. We're not experts at that by any means. That's one of the reasons is we're moving into enforcement right now. We're learning how to do this and how to get the greatest value out of that system. It means you need enough analysts working with that systems and data to pull out that information so that we can actually go do our work in the field and make sure that we have a diversion-free system. Turn it over to Bill now.
So related to the marijuana program, our first governor's recommended policy option package, number 406, we're requesting one more regulatory specialist for the Medford region. Overview is the Medford region has about 33% of all the grow operations. These are often the most complex and difficult to license from a licensing standpoint. There are currently two regulatory specialists in the Medford region, and we feel if one more would be able to provide enforcement resources for the higher density area of licensees. And the governor's recommended budget is recommending to add one specialist to this to cover the increased enforcement needs. And then the second policy option package related to the marijuana program is a conversion of a limited duration position of a compliance 3 specialist. This is a position that was granted to us in our original budget for marijuana in the administrative policy and process unit that does the hearings. This was initially granted as a limited duration. We're requesting it be continued as another limited duration at least through the next biennium. Expected need for additional hearings, potential related to the rejection of licenses and worker permits. This position has to learn the statute. They have to be aware of the marijuana laws, and it's very difficult if we have to lose this expertise.
While we're here, I just want you to know this governor's budget was prepared on a forecast that were over a year ago. Now we've seen the experience of the doubling of the licenses coming in. So when we come back to you for funding, we're working with LFO and Destin to come back to you to it with a proposal that fits the growth and revenue that we can achieve and self-fund a higher level of operation than you see proposed here. And Dustin will add.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, Dustin Ball at the Chief Financial Office. And I'll also add that we updated the revenue projections in the governor's budget. I believe initially we were projecting when the agency requested, turned in their agency request budget, they were looking at roughly 800 licensees. We updated that in the governor's budget to roughly 1,000 licensees, based on the information we had at the time that the governor's budget was released, with the understanding that we would probably need to take another look at the actual licensee count during the legislative process. And this program is driven by the fees generated from the actual licensees and the renewals that will be subsequently following that.
Moving on, to give Mr. Marks a little bit of a break, I'll handle the next program, which is our integrated administration and support services. What you're looking up here and seeing here is generally what is common through a lot of state government, although I'll point out a few, especially the policy option package that we were talking about before, our APMP unit. Our policy and process does hearings for both marijuana and alcohol. We expect those workloads to increase. Our financial services is not just about paying bills and collecting revenue, but they operate as a business. I mean, we are operating a business, and we have business functions as well, including tracking sales, store audits, payments to vendors, inventory management. So as Mr. Marks talked about, he gets profit loss statements almost on a monthly basis. And then a little bit about IT on this is a combination of the old and new systems. You probably heard a lot about the old systems. We also have a lot of new systems, and so our IT management is also becoming more and more complex. And then the next to the KPM, number 4, is our customer satisfaction rate. This is a measure that all agencies have to do. We do overall rate, is what you're seeing here, but we do a subsample of distinct stakeholder groups such as licensees, industry stakeholders, manufacturers, liquor agents, alcohol education providers. One change in this KPM is we will be adding marijuana licensees and stakeholders to the survey as proposed in a new KPM. The amount was raised to 85%. The target was raised to 85% in 2014. We have yet to raise that new goal, but we have seen some progress since at least 2013.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I might suggest that this is something that the committee takes a pretty serious look at, because if we've got a backlog as deep as the one that you've got and a questionable ability for you to catch up timely, you're going to end up with some cranky people. And I just think that we ought to flag it.
Administration and support services goals on that. We want to continue all of our IT, extensive IT work for all of those good reasons that you need IT. But, you know, we need to operate. We have old records management system. We need to eliminate, you know, the need to enter the licensee's data in the license system and then into the card file and then onto moving it through the system in that way. We want to improve on the integration of that. We want to improve on online electronic systems, both on marijuana and alcohol. You know, we've initiated, we can just flip the page here because I think it's more impressive about the number of, it just shows you the number of things we have going on around IT. We've got old problems that need to be fixed in terms of records management and our base systems of operations. We've got a number of contract enterprise projects. We've got the cannabis tracking system. We have the online licensing system for marijuana. We're developing the ways for us to get to the online alcohol licensing system. We need internal functionality around these. Then let me make the point that big business that I was talking about is all of those systems down at the bottom of this page. You know, we came off Cobalt. We've now got an Empower Builder, some other platform sitting there. But this system is limited in adaptability to doing new things. It's limited in its capabilities. And you just gave us, and we put to good use, the conveyor system that moves at relatively light speed. It moves much quicker than we did before. The logistics of our operation are moving faster. They're moving at the speed of business. We do we schedule carriers in and load the trucks. I told you about we need to get the even loads in place. We have operational issues that are there and not having full-time, and we have a staff that is. We do have an IT staff. They do a great job at servicing these systems, and they're full out. We spend most of our time where most of our value is, making sure that the retail and liquor side of this continues to work well. Our internal systems are suffering now from a lack of resource, and we are lacking additional expertise, I think, to move these projects forward. I know our executive team, and myself have personally, put our direct time into working with IT contractors. And while I'm not saying we won't be successful on a limited basis, that's not a situation you want this kind of enterprise in. We will do our best job possible with the resources that we have there. But if I was flagging a great weakness in this agency today, it is in the area of IT and IT coordination. And it is becoming overwhelming to us to make sure that we do it right, that we actually have these new systems talk and in place, and we have a variety of systems that are converging right now. So there's a moment of convergence in IT for OLCC. Legislation. Speaking of convergence, there's legislation to move electronic privilege tax filing system forward. I think of this as the tracking system for alcohol. This is really how we collect beer and wine taxes, and this will make it much more efficient if that legislation comes forward. This is not in our budget. It is separate legislation, so if it came forward, it would be something that we would be asked to do. It is necessary. I think it's important to the beer and wine and manufacturers and shipper community that we have something like this in place. It'll help with our auditing and verification that we're collecting all the taxes needed and spend time to and the time spent on those audits and allow us to keep current. So this is a potential investment, and I believe it moved out of committee this week. Marijuana tax distribution, there is legislation that deals with that issue. I know this is near and dear to the co-chair Johnson's heart that we actually get efficient with making this distribution work. It's been difficult to work. I think people understand that some of those problems are related to the opt-in and opt-out cities and counties, and we're having a hard time reconciling that last piece of information. to put out the bulk of the money that's owed, one, the repayment of the liquor funds, and there's way sufficient money to repay what we borrowed out of liquor funds to fund this. It will happen. But it's that we haven't been able to make that net calculation yet around this formula. This bill would require quarterly certifications, I believe, of the city and county status. It's not for me to say, it's certainly for the legislature and others to say, but this moving in and out of the opt-out status with respect to the distribution of money, it just seems like it can be, the legislature, I think, in its overall policy can help make this efficient.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
This has been a continuing lamentation from me, and that is to not see all of the expense and income side for marijuana in one place. We work on this committee system, so necessarily all of us only see little snippets. And I don't know, for example, I think that you've told me, Mr. Marks, that the liquor fund had been paid back from the initial $10 million advance.
It has not been paid back, Co-Chair Johnson, but the funds are available. There's more than sufficient funds to pay it back. We're just awaiting revenue to be able to make the final determinations around the formula and the accuracy of it to put it out. And just to the point there is the legislature, I think, even through working on this issue, could make sure that happened, because we're talking about the smaller amount of payment to the opt-in and opt-out counties, and it seems like you could reserve that until it's rectified and trued up.
Well, I've talked to LFO about this repeatedly to find out what was advanced and what has been paid back. Armor plating the Department of Revenue's building so they could receive cash cost a lot of money, and that was money that was advanced. And I'm just trying to see the whole fiscal presentation in one place at one time, so you don't have to run from committee to committee to get whatever little nibble they're working on. And I have reason to believe, and Ms. Dicer is looking at me as though she perhaps has an answer.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, back in, I believe it was April, the Legislative Fiscal Office did produce a white paper with regard to expenses up to that point of the system entirely, up to that point. It may very well be due for an update, but up to that point, that is out there, and it's on the LFO website.
Thank you.
Go into the marijuana program now as the program itself. I'll try to cover this pretty quickly, but if you have questions, hop in. We facilitate licensing the worker permit process. We've talked extensively about that. We have the cannabis tracking system. We need more analyzing of the data that comes out of there. We need to learn and get our skills more proficient at really using that as a tool to guide our enforcement, and also to do training of our licensees so that they know how to use the system. It's not an impossible system for our licensees to use by a far cry. Most licensees use it well, but it's developing. We prepare a lot of educational bulletins and notices, specifically because we have a lot of tricky issues that come up around tracking system, around our rules and regulations, around changing federal status of hemp, for instance. We coordinate extensively and most frequently with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Department of Revenue. We have good relationships with all agencies. We put in place interagency agreements. I think, you know, we did that last biennium pretty quickly. Some of these probably come with financial relationships that haven't been divined yet between the work that we're doing. I know ODA is doing an extensive amount of work around cannabis, and they don't really have a compensation system for that. We do a lot of work for Department of Revenue on the financials and tax collections. So we're working through and continue to refine those agreements and the content in them. We coordinate a lot with outside vendors. We've had good relationships with Metric Framwell, who is our contractor on the cannabis tracking system, and NIC USA on the cannabis, on the licensing system. Try to, as best we can and as extensive as we can, coordinate with local government. Certainly our system requires it to be so because we require the land use compatibility statements to come into place. We're currently working with AOC and LOC on getting in the certifications of their opt-in, opt-out status around a variety of different types of licensees within their jurisdictions. And then we approve all packaging and all labeling. The goals for the program are, one, build up our capability to analyze data and use it for enforcement, to improve the online licensing system so that we can use more back-end features in working on that system and tracking licensing. Same there with the cannabis tracking system. We are building in some back-end features that will help us improve the data that we use. We're going to provide ongoing development and distribution of educational materials and training materials that continues to be of high importance to us, as is the continuous training of our staff and the continuous training of our licensees. This is a field that is changing rapidly, and the training is imperative and helps keep people from getting into really tricky compliance issues. We have a couple of licensees that have made unfortunate, very costly mistakes. Good licensees, all reported, but mistakes, the kind of product they produce by rule, it's probably going to cost them, and we don't have the wherewithal to provide flexibility for circumstances that are fully outside the rules. We coordinate a lot of public information, 3.9 million hits on our website. People are looking at extensive documents like our rules and our business readiness guide. We did prepare for the cannabis industry a complete business readiness guide, so it had sort of an introductory, and it was in conjunction with the governor's office and a lot of agencies, but we've continuously updated it. Talks about banking, talks about insurance, talks about getting local permits, talks about all of those things that a real small business needs to do to operate in our communities. And I'll bring a copy for the record. It's worth having in there. It's a good guide. Coordinate with states on best practices, be meeting with them, I think that's next week, and we're hoping to gain some knowledge of best practices from Colorado and Washington and Alaska. Alaska's a little behind us. The other two are a little in front of us. We've already gleaned from their systems, and now they're gleaning a few things from us as well, so it'll be a good chance to learn how to do this better. And then continued work on interagency coordination and policy development. Legislation, you've heard me, we've talked about it in snippets along the way here, but there's a major bill that would essentially in OMMP at 2019 provide a way for those large numbers of potential licensees to come over to our system. We would devise a way to ration out and hold in place in the first instance, and then ration out the speed and pace of fully licensing them into the tracked OLCC system. It also sets up that cannabis advisory or committee, or the medical use board, I'm sorry. The medical use board. I believe the bill, Senator Johnson, does have the governor making appointments to that board. It is a gubernatorial level board. It's to be housed with an OHA. So that said, that's a lot of work for us. That'll be, you know, if we've doubled up now, this will double us up again. If we are asked to do this work, it'll be a lot. We have physical capacity issues at our current facility. We're going to have to, even maybe to deal with our existing problems, get some lease space and move some staff offline. out of the Milwaukee headquarters to make operations work. This would add to that, but this has some good policy goals of providing the incentives to put people on the track system so that we, all of our systems in the state, can be coal memo compliant. We don't know what the world holds in terms of federal regulatory oversight, but our best shot is to have a system like the one that we've developed at OLCC. And then if that bill, if the integration doesn't happen, there are many components that were put into that legislation that are technical authority fixes, flexibility on the way to allow us to met out sanctions more readily, just a variety of improvements to our system. So if for some reason the integration was not to move forward, we would really advocate for the technical changes and other authorities to go forward without integration.
So on the home stretch here, I'm going to give just a brief overview of the agency by the numbers, and I just want to make the point that, again, with the implementation of recreational marijuana for almost 80 years plus, the Liquor Control Commission just had one account, and that was a liquor fund. With the implementation of marijuana, a new account was created, the Marijuana Regulatory Fund, which requires separate accounting, has a separate revenue source, has some differences. I'm also going to talk about the revenue proposals in a little more detail in the governor's recommended budget. Just moving on, the large pie chart here, this is the entire agency of projected revenues. Pretty much everything, with the exception of marijuana licensing fees, is related to the liquor revenue fund, liquor fund. Marijuana license fees go into the marijuana regulatory fund. With respect to the specific governor's recommended budget revenue proposals, again, to get in a little more detail, the governor's recommended budget is proposing a move from the surcharge of moving it from 50 cents a bottle to a dollar per bottle. The current surcharge of 50 cents per bottle has been extended through the current June 30th, 2019 biennium, expected to generate $36.5 million. The GRB has proposed an additional surcharge of 50 cents to bring it to a dollar. This surcharge, as Ms. Deister pointed out, has been dedicated exclusively to legislature or to the general fund, but it has not been approved by the commission as of yet. The alcohol licensing fees expected to generate $9.5 million in distributed revenue, doubling just the annual license fees, not the service permits fees. This will require a statute change. The ORS is there. Again, this will go through the distribution formula. 56% of this amount will go to the general fund, with the remaining going to cities and counties. And then in GRB, the final 3% revenue increase due to retail expansion. I misspoke the other day. It wasn't $75 million. It's actually $38.3 million gross, with a $15.8 million in distributed revenue after manufacturer's cost and agent's comp and credit card fees are taken out of it. Currently, we have 254 liquor stores operating with a target of 310. This will require some resources to meet the forecasted expansion efforts. Just on the alcohol side, this is a breakout. The great majority of our revenue, 95%, comes from distilled spirits. You can also see the beer and wine tax, liquor licensing fees with the GRB proposal, miscellaneous revenues from like sales to casinos and that sort of thing, other sources, for projected $1.43 billion in total gross revenue for the 17-19 biennium. And then just a little education on the alcohol side. How does our business work? This is the bottle that breaks down the different cost and different of a bottle of liquor in the state of Oregon. 2016, the average price per bottle was $17. About half of that is manufacturer's cost. 8.93% goes to the liquor agents for commission. 1% in bank card cost. About 72% of all these are all purchases are made with bank cards. And 5% is the actual total revenue or operating cost for the entire agency. If it was just the distribution center, it'd be quite a bit smaller. but the public benefit is also a small sliver of that. Includes enforcement, licensing, and distribution, and then 37% net profit for cities, counties, and general fund. Projected alcohol distribution, it's formula-based, based in statutes. Total, we're looking at $615 million total distributions. I would only point out that the $662,000 for the wine board is a 2 cents per gallon tax added to the wine tax. The rest of it all comes from liquor funds, license revenues, and beer and wine tax.
Senator.
Could you pause there for just a moment and refresh my memory? Is the wine board looking in this session for an increase? Just remind me.
Yeah. Co-Chair Johnson, I believe there's a bill. I don't have the number in my mind right now, but they were looking for a one-time distribution, I believe, of $1.5 million for marketing efforts.
That's right. Okay. Madam Co-Chair, that bill came to the Business and Transportation Committee that I sit on. And it would take $1.5 million, really basically out of the general fund for their marketing efforts. It's controversial and may not move.
This is just a snapshot. I won't go through every one of them, but this is where liquor dollars go. Again, the cities and counties get a pretty significant distribution. Portland is the biggest recipient of $17 million in a biennium. Some of the smaller cities get enough to fund, at least hopefully a one position at public safety or any other use they choose to put it towards.
Okay, nice.
And then on the marijuana side, again, this gets back to the marijuana regulatory account. The only thing I wanted to point out here was that currently in the GRB, the revenue forecast is $10.7 million with 1,400 applications. As Mr. Ball pointed out, we have revised that now with the current applications of 2,200 with the resources to process these licenses. We could expect as much as $16.6 million to fund an additional resource needs, but it gets into the chicken and egg thing. And then finally, just to point out, Department of Revenue is responsible for the distribution, but we feel we do contribute to it. But there is right now in the GRB almost $115 million in marijuana distribution, about slated for the 17-19 biennium.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
That's all specified. That distribution formula is specified by the ballot measure, is it not?
Yes, Senator Johnson, that's correct. And the common school fund might actually be changed to the school fund, I understand. I guess there are some differences there I don't quite understand, but yes, that is specified by a ballot measure. But there is legislation that may choose or rearrange some of the distribution to the cities and the counties. And then finally, the recap of the budgets themselves. Again, two separate budgets. The total budget for liquor is $192.7 million for marijuana. The big differences here is that on the liquor side, excess revenue is distributed through the formulas we saw before. On the marijuana side, excess revenues are carried forward. It is a fee-funded program, so we can raise fees, lower fees, according to what the cost of the program is expected to be. On an agency management basis, we hope to do that at least maybe on a biennial basis. We hate to be on a 6 month, but or something shorter than that. But we try to set our fees that will carry us through the existing biennium at least. And on the marijuana side versus liquor, these license fees are set in rule. So we can go through rulemaking, put in advisory committees, adjust the fees as needed. But to your point, Senator Johnson, how high can the fees go? And then finally, just a snapshot of total expenditures for the agency here. The note that the great majority of our expenditures is agents' compensation at $127 million. Also, credit card fees. Note, we do pick up the credit card fees for our liquor stores, $14.2 million for a total of $202.8 million in expenditures, 264 FTE. And our last key performance measure, our return on
investment. I'm going to interrupt you for a second. Yes, Senator Johnson.
Have you visited with the Treasurer's Office at all about the power of the state's purchasing on credit card to see if we can cut a better deal? Now that we're expanding the use of credit cards to a variety of different places, I'm wondering if we're getting a very sharp pencil out to see what kind of a good deal we can get versus what's receipted back to the credit card vendors.
Senator Johnson, I'll let Mr. Marks comment as well. But
that's great. Throw your boss under the bus right in front of the whole committee.
I can tell you that our average credit card rate is 1.7%. It has come down in recent years. I know Treasury does help negotiate those, but our amount for credit card fees has come down in recent years, and I'll defer to Mr. Marks for the rest of it.
Yeah, and I haven't had recent conversations with them, and, you know, there's that debate about whether these are costs that should be borne in our system or whether we should just compensate them overall and figure out the POS and the compensation of credit cards differently than we do today. We are pursuing and have with the Treasurer's Office, and this will help with retail expansion. We found frustration with, and it's a long-standing problem, the public funds law. And public funds, as soon as I hand you the cash for the state liquor bottle you just bought in my retail location, that becomes public funds, and that's why you always had to have the separate POS systems and pretty complicated, and we couldn't use normal ACH, you know, banking transfers, and people can use their normal banking system accounts. If this legislation goes forward, and Senator Beyer is taking it forward in his committee, it would help us with expansion because, you know, now we're going in and in some of these retailers, you know, it's not like you're just going to sell our liquor. We're not the it's not the tail wagging the dog here, right? We're bringing in a bottle of liquor to a store or a store that has a variety of products already in an existing POS system. What's important for us and is not the cost recovery or the risk of losing the transaction there. I mean, we have the risk of all of the liquor we own sitting in the store on the floor. So we have much higher risk than this short period of financial transactions. The thing that's important to us is that we get the daily sales data reported into our system.
Please, Senator.
A question that I had, and I don't know whether this is anecdotal and sort of urban mythology, but the fact that that is public money, a question, does it have to be receipted to a bank, specifically a U.S. bank, at end of day, or are you allowed to collect finances and bank in a more systematic manner?
You're close, and I probably won't be entirely accurate, but I think in these circumstances, they like us to get it in and get it into a state account 24 hours straight away, and generally they want to use where the accounts are state certified. I'm missing the term of art there.
And how's that work out for a little tiny retailer where the banking options may not be robust?
Yeah, well, some, you know, we come in with the smaller folks and we'll put in the, you know, work with them on the POS and vendors so we can provide them the assistance to get them lined up if they're starting up. And we do make it pretty easy for them. But, you know, it's really come, and it is problematic. It's problematic in some rural areas where you just can't get banking to your bank.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, you can't travel the distance. It's not open. So it is problematic for some of our rural stores. We have gained, through the public funds law, some exceptions around some of the practices that we have. But this new issue is so ubiquitous, and ACH transfers are so reliable. You know, the rest of the world's business relies on those. We thought we could, too. So I think we're going to get the power to make rules to make those more efficient.
So the good senator has tugged on one of my favorite loose threads, going back to the credit card question. Other than actually making retail purchases, are we accepting credit cards to pay for other larger expenses, whether it be license applications or other payments?
I've got guys waiting in my office.
So I know for the new online systems, yes, credit card payments are being made. I don't know if the pay at our window for a license, if you can use a credit card. No, at the license.
All right, the time is winding down. I think we're getting close to the end here. Please, go ahead.
I just want to say, in the development of the new online alcohol licensing system, that is something that we're planning to build in as well.
Okay, very good.
And our last slide on the financials is our final key performance measure. This is our return on investment. Basically, it defines for every dollar spent by the agency, target of returning $2.75 to the state of Oregon. Most years we've been able to exceed that. This last year with significant expenses with related to the roof and to the conveyor system, we failed to meet that target. So instead of the meeting was $2.75, we were down at $2.51. Without those expenses, we would have been at $2.96. Again, these are one-time expenses. A similar occurrence occurred back in 2007 when we purchased the Millport warehouse. But moving forward, we expect to return hopefully even more.
This KPM always bugs me right now, just because it says if you make a one-time investment in your efficiencies, that you're inefficient in that period you made the investment.
All right. And does that conclude your presentation for us today?
Yes.
All right.
Yes,
quick question for you, if I may. Redemption value on beer bottles is going up in Oregon. Do we have any sense of what the total redemption value is on an annual basis?
We do. We can get you the answers. I don't have the right expertise in the room to get that for you immediately, sir.
Well, the question I've got, and I'll tell you, I am now channeling Senator Monroe. I'd like to know whether the redemption value on those bottles exceeds the current beer tax on the contents of those bottles.
Chair Gomberg, I don't know if we can drill down directly to the beer bottles. I can get you the total containers. Both for glass, metal, and plastic. So we do have those numbers, but I don't know if we can get down to the beer bottles or not.
All right. Well, we'll chat about that again later. Let's
channeling
go ahead.
The answer, I bet it's yes.
Absolutely, yes, by a considerable amount.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. All right. So let's go ahead and wrap things up for today. Ms. Dyster, where are we going on Monday?
On Monday, the committee is scheduled for public testimony on this particular bill. If there are no additional slides, wrap-up, or questions that the committee might have between now and then. So.
Excellent. Well, we've got a weekend coming. I encourage the committee to do some research independently. And and I'm going to go ahead and conclude the public hearing on 5019. Anything else for the good of the order? Then we are adjourned.
Thank you.